Sunday, October the 19th.
Welcome to this Burlington Audio Podcast. We hope you will be encouraged and inspired in your faith as you listen to this message. We'd love to hear what you think. Please be in touch with us through the website. More information and many more podcasts are all at burlingtonbaptist.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Great. Good morning, everybody. My name's Simon, if you don't know. I'm part of the team here. And today, as Jacob introduced, is our TED Talk Sunday. Now, TED Talks became famous because they were short, to the point, and helped us think about an idea or something that perhaps we hadn't thought about before. We're taking that kind of frame to enable us to hear from different people in our church as they reflect on the same passage. So this morning, we're going to hear Sophie and Anne-Marie and William. You all still with us? Reflect on the story of the Tower of Babel, which is what was just read to us from Jacob. And the reason that we're using that passage is that we're in a series in Genesis, the beginning of everything. And we're taking those early stories in Genesis and we're asking the big question, why are they there? Why does the Bible start off with all of these stories? What did it mean to those people that first heard them? And what did the experience of those early people teach us about the way that we live today? And so as part of that series, we're going to look at this particular passage today. So in a moment, Sophie's going to come and speak to us just for a few minutes. And at the end of that time, we're just going to pause together. I'll lead us. And we're just going to ask ourselves the question, what is God saying to me in the light of what I've just heard? What's God saying to me in the light of what I've just heard? So we're not going to listen passively. We're going to listen actively, we're going to lean in, and we're going to allow their experience and their reflection to illuminate our own experience and reflections. Okay, all good? Yeah, we're a warm, yeah, come, do start. Round of applause. We're a warm crowd, aren't we? This is... You okay? Yeah, come on. You just go for it. Like, even if they look a bit kind of like, just like that, don't they? Just sort of stare at you. Can you see them? But inside, they're really going for it with you, all right? They're really with you.
Guys, so I wanted to start by asking you a question. If you stripped away everything that you do just to impress other people, what would be left? I used to care way too much about what others thought of me, and to the point where it was shaping everything that I did. I'd say yes to things I didn't really want to do. I'd change how I acted depending on who I was around. But no matter how many people liked me, I never actually really felt secure in who I was, because deep down I didn't know who I was without all the approval and validation. And I think we kind of see this with the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. It's easy to read as just a story about a bunch of people building a tower. But I'd say that actually there's something deeper happening. It says, come let us build a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. So you can see they weren't really building this tower for shelter or safety, but more for significance. Maybe they wanted to prove something to themselves, prove something to each other, or even prove something to God. And I think today we might not be stacking bricks, as in building towers physically, but we build towers out of grades, careers, relationships, popularity, achievements, whatever it takes to make a name for ourselves. And the problem isn't the building itself, but the motive behind it. Because when our identity is based on what we can do or what others say, we're just one mistake or one bad comment or one failure away from everything falling apart. And that's the same as what happens in this story. God confuses their language and suddenly everything they built crumbles. And the people who just wanted to make a name for themselves so badly end up scattered and nameless. There was a time when my whole sense of worth depended on how people saw me. On the outside, I tried to look confident, like I had everything together. But underneath, I was just scared people would see the real me and decide that that wasn't enough. And the real issue wasn't what they thought, but that I didn't know who I was without their approval. I think lots of us know in theory that our identity is in God, but emotionally we still crave the approval of other people, especially people we love or respect. And maybe your tower is different from mine. Success at work, being the perfect parent, having a certain image online. Maybe it's trying to prove you're enough in a world that constantly tells us we're not. But when we build on those things, our sense of worth is always going to be unstable. Because when the compliments stop, when the promotion doesn't come, when the likes go down, we crumble, just like the people in the story. When you know your identity is secure in who God says you are, not in what you do or who approves of you, I think that's when you truly find freedom. Freedom to love people without needing their validation. Freedom to fail without losing your sense of worth. Freedom to serve without fearing being perceived. And when you know your identity in Christ, achievement becomes more of an expression of gratitude, not a way to earn belonging. I think we all spend a lot of time trying to be impressive, but what if the version of us that doesn't have anything to prove is the one that God actually wants most?
That was insanely brilliant, wasn't it? That was a feast in 5 minutes. Totally brilliant. Let's be quiet. What's the bit that stands out for you? Was it that bit at the beginning about identity, or that glimpse of freedom, or that laying down what you're doing to make a name for yourself? Where did what Sophie said resonate with your own experience? Okay, here we go. Would you give Anne-Marie a welcome, everybody?
It's no pressure, Sophie. So I'm going to talk to you about building a life without God. The Tower of Babel illustrates human striving for significance apart from God. When we prioritize our own ways over God's, we risk losing sight of his divine plan. And that was my story. That was my experience for many years. I had a plan for my life which didn't include Jesus. I was brought up in a Christian family. But then I went through a rebellious phase, and my rebellious phase lasted into my 30s. I turned my back on Jesus entirely. I think those seeds were probably planted early, though, in my Christian upbringing. And for some reason, when I got married, I remember saying to my husband, I couldn't get married in a registry office. It had to be in a church, because the vows that I made wouldn't hold unless they were in the eyes of God. So something in my early upbringing had actually stayed with me. My first rebellion was that I didn't want to be a nurse or a teacher like most women were expected to be back in the day. I was going to be a speech therapist. But God scuppered that plan very quickly, and I became a teacher. And actually, I really enjoyed it. It was a career that God had planned for me. It was part of God's plan for me. Our first child was born, Hannah. And then a son followed. Perfect family. A boy and a girl. My plan. Not God's plan. My plan. Then a curveball was thrown by the way of Bethany, a number three, and we found it very, very difficult. Life was extremely difficult for my family and I because my husband was training to be a computer programmer. It was in the early days of computing, and we had no money. We were really, really strapped for cash. And I needed to work. So I returned to teaching when Beth was round about four. And then my life changed because I became pregnant with Simon. And by that stage, both my husband and I had returned to church. I wouldn't say I had a close relationship with God. I didn't. But at that point, I turned to him and surrendered my whole life and my plan, my life's plan. I said to God, I can't cope. I can't do this. I've got to surrender my life to you, and you've got to become daily a part of my life. And it was so much better. Oh, my goodness me, it was so much better. My life changed for the better. Simon was born, and I know I've said this, told this story to many people. I've never, ever been able to close his drawers. The provision, I didn't have a pram, a baby vest. I didn't have any clothes for him when Simon was born. But God provided. Clothes came from everywhere. And he's never, and still at the age of 35, he can never close his drawers. They are full to overflowing. God's provision has always been great. My Christian head allowed me to go back to work 2 days. When Simon was, he was born on the 13th of December. On the 12th of January, I returned to work, fully healed after a fourth cesarean section. God provided that healing for me. It was all in God's plan. I'm not saying that submitting, surrendering to God's plan is easy. I'm a teacher. I plan daily lesson notes. I'm a planner. I'm an organizer. It doesn't come naturally. But I found in older age as well that asking God to becoming part of my daily plan, my daily routine, he drives with me, he goes places with me, he goes for walks with me. He's part of my daily plan. In conclusion, at the moment, we feel that this world, there's lots of doom and gloom, isn't there? We feel that the world's in not a good place. It's been there before, actually. We've gone through these periods of doom and gloom previously. I listen to my older children now debating a need for globalization or should we be in support of nationalism. I just listen because I know that God has got a plan for this world. If we listen to Jeremiah 29:11, he says, I know the plans I have for you, plans for peace and well-being, not for disaster, and to give you a future and hope. If you can surrender your life to God's plan, it makes life so much easier.
Fabulous. Let's just have that discipline of being quiet for a minute with open hearts, open minds, allowing those words of surrender, of his plan, transcending our plans, of God having a plan and a purpose individually and nationally, globally. Where's God getting your attention? Where did you feel the tug of maybe where you suddenly have that moment of realization you're chasing your own plan right now in that area of your life. And so let's give William a Burlington welcome, everybody.
So, no pressure, Sophie, no pressure, Anne-Marie. Good morning, everybody. Those of you that know me will know that I was brought up on a small farm in County Antrim in Northern Ireland. Not like one of the farms you get in East Anglia where you've got fields the size of a Midwest prairie and a tractor the size of, half the size of a house. But it would probably fit into a corner of one of the fields here. But this time of the year, it would be harvest, and farmers would come together to help each other with the harvest. Everybody would share machinery, they would share labour, they would share jobs to be done. Everybody knew what to do, and the objective was to get the harvest in before the weather turned bad. So everybody was working to a common purpose. Now, Genesis chapter 11 tells the story about a much greater group of people, the whole world, who have come together with a common purpose to build a city and a tower that will reach to the heavens. Now, it's probably fair to say that most people in the church could summarize the story of the Tower of Babel as something you learn in Sunday school. And to be honest, I don't think we'd learn too much about it after that there. But the story goes something like, group of people come together to build a tower, to build a city, it's going to reach to the heavens, and then God doesn't like that. He comes down, thwarts their plans, they get scattered across the earth, and we move on. Now, the story written by Moses appears almost as a side story in here. Before it, in chapter 10, there's all the story about the nations and how they developed. And then after that, we go on to Abraham's genealogy. So it's almost like something sitting alongside it. I think Moses is actually answering a question that would have arisen in chapter 10. How did all the languages come about? But it just sits there, and the way we block up the Bible into chapters means that we can go to chapter 10 at the start, and we don't see the bit before, and we don't see the bit after. But if you stand back and think about it, this is a truly momentous story. It's a fantastic story in its own right, but it actually points to the time when there was this huge schism between the people on earth and God. This is where God more or less abandoned them to their own devices, and their redemption would have to come later. So I think there's much more in the story than we truly appreciate. So when I looked again at these first verses, three things stood out to me. That's my Presbyterian roots coming out from County Antrim. But the people had a common speech and language. So why does Moses say that? When I joined BT all those years ago, I joined the speech division, and one of the jobs I had to do was capture a database of people speaking English in England. And because we all speak English, but we speak it with a different dialect, you have to capture lots and lots of people speaking to do that. But Moses is making the point that they have the same language, the same speech, they all say the same words, and they all mean the same things. So culturally, they're the same. And you need language to convey ideas. So the idea that they were working together to build this city and build this tower is something that everybody was focused on. It wasn't just a thing that leaders were doing and they were paying people to do, or they were slaves being forced to do it. It was a common project. And Moses says that the reason for building the city so that they could make a name for themselves, so that they wouldn't be scattered over the face of all the earth. The thinking was probably something like, everybody else will see how powerful we are, how clever we are, how strong we are, and this is a safe place for us to be. But remember that in chapter 1 of Genesis, Adam and Eve were told to multiply and fill the earth. And then this commandment was again repeated after the flood, when Noah was told to multiply and fill the earth. So the people, when they said they were going to build the city and build the tower, they wouldn't be scattered across the earth. That was in direct contradiction to God's command. And in their arrogance, in that direct confrontation with God, they were generally in a bad place. So the next piece of information that jumps out to me, coming from an engineering background, is their method of construction. It's going to be built with bricks and not stones. So you might say, well, that's obvious because they were in a plane and there wouldn't be any rocks there to build with. But they were actually going to build with bricks that were going to be fired in a kiln. So there's two ways of baking bricks. You can sun-dry them or you can bake them. When you bake a brick, it becomes like one of our engineering bricks. It's much stronger, but it's also waterproof. So if you build the walls with these waterproof bricks and you put tar in between them, you're going to get a waterproof wall. So is that what Moses is telling us here, that they were going to build this city such that it would be waterproof and the tar would be waterproof? And were they building it in case there would be another flood coming along? Remember, this wasn't long after the flood when this was taking place. So had they forgotten God's covenant with Noah, when never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth? So it looks like the construction has the potential for more confrontation with God. Now, the people are busy building the city and the tower, which is going to be seen for miles around on the plain. So imagine it, city with walls, a huge tower. The tower is likely to be made of coloured brick because of the firing, and it's going to stand out very impressively in the landscape. So think Eiffel Tower or NatWest Tower or Trump Tower. And when that happens, the third thing that intrigues me is God comes down to see what's going on. So they're building the tower to reach the God, but God comes down to see what's going on. It's a bit like when you're minding children and you leave them alone for a few minutes. It's amazing the mischief they can get up to in a short time. You know, the curtains become goalposts, the walls become art galleries with crayons. And it must have felt something like that, only much, much worse for God. It seems that he came down in physical form, the way that Moses writes the story. So we have this scene where God's wandering around the site, observing what's going on, maybe asking questions of the people, and no one recognized him. There's something very ironic in the fact that the people are beavering away building this tower, and it's going to reach the heavens, and God has to leave heaven to come down to see what it is. It suggests it wasn't really that big of a tower in the first place. However, what God saw was that the people were united in building the city and the tower, and it caused him to be concerned. It wasn't concerned, I think, for any challenge that they could make to him, but more for the damage that they could do to themselves. So in a judgment, which is almost in some ways an act of mercy, he did something to their language that caused them not to be able to understand each other. And that caused the project to stop and they ended up being scattered. Now, the story could have ended there with the people separated from God, but God offers a way back to him. He started again through Abram, and Moses follows the story about Babel with a description of Abram's genealogy. Interestingly, when we move beyond the genealogy in chapter 11 and move to chapter 12, where God's speaking directly to Abram and establishing his covenant with him, he says, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great. This is in stark contrast to the story of Babel, where the people are building the city and tower to make a name for themselves. So, how should we interpret what happened to Babel today? So, in our Western culture, we applaud success, we applaud achievements. Think of the development of a child. We cheer at the first smile, we cheer at the first rollover, the first time they crawl, the first steps they take, the first words they say, and so on through exam results, sporting achievements, etc., etc. And as a man, you're conditioned to be a breadwinner, to provide the home, to pay the bills, to support a family. To do that, you have to be successful. You have to make a name for yourself, in effect. But Noah's descendants set out to make that name in the absence of God. So in my own working life, I set out to do the same thing, to get the next promotion, the next pay rise, driven by the conditioning and the need to have some visible sign of success. Was that always with God? If I'm honest with you and honest with myself, I suspect not, because those promotions brought with them long days, stress and sleepless nights. Now, it all came to a full stop when I had a heart bypass operation in 2011. On the day that I left work to go and prepare for the operation, a colleague, a good friend of mine, some of you will know him, Marshall, said to me that it must be scary to have an operation as serious as that. And my honest reply was that it was all in God's hands. If it was up to him, if I survived, he must have something planned for me to do. And so I had the operation, and cut a long story short, I eventually gave up full-time working. And now, like the Apostle Paul, I feel contentment in the things that he has laid out for me to do. So that's my story. So the question for us all is, are we working hard through our own efforts, building towers to make names for ourselves? It could be that next promotion, that next pay rise, the fancy car, the bigger house, or some other thing. Or are we allowing God to work in us and through us to make us be the people that he wants us to be, in effect, to give us the name that he wants us to have?
Wow, I feel like I've had a feast. Let's same discipline, just for a moment. A story, as William has so helpfully articulated, people that wanted to make their name great. And then on the very next page, God says, I'll do that for you. I will make your name great. I wonder whether there's somewhere where you're doing the equivalent of building with waterproof bricks. In other words, God's made a promise, but you're living as if he never said it. Or you recognize that drivenness by the conditioning of the people around you, the expectations of society or others. And actually, there's a cost to that. And maybe God wants to stop you in your tracks in a similar kind of way. So I'd love you just to reflect on all three of those talks to us today. Where's God getting your overall attention? So I was really struck by what Sophie said about theoretically we might know that our approval comes from God, and yet emotionally we're still looking for it somewhere else. Struck by what Anne-Marie said about surrender. And personally, I was struck by what William said about contentment. What have you been struck by this morning? I'd love you to turn to the people around you. And there are three questions. What's God saying to you? How do you feel, and what are you going to do about it? Off you go. Okay. And so as we carry in our hearts what we're thinking and what we're sharing, we're just going to use this song as our response to bring ourselves afresh to God. Whether it's a comfort that we've heard today that we're taking hold of, or a challenge that we've heard that we're stepping into, we're recognizing that He is God. And He comes down to us. We can't by ourselves build a tower that will reach the heavens. How presumptuous. How lacking in perspective. But there is a God who comes and meets with us.